Good afternoon, everyone. So I'm going to define a few terms after I go through the introductory slides so we're all on the same page. I have no personal or financial relationships to disclose, and I'd like to acknowledge my former mentors at Oregon State University, my current mentors at Center for AIDS Intervention Research, the National Institutes of Mental Health for funding the center, as well as the postdoctoral training program, and then my community-based organizations, Gate City, Cascades Project, and Q Center, and Seattle and Portland, respectively, for their help, and last but not least, the couples who have participated in the study. I'm going to talk about how adherence to a sexual agreement may help reduce HIV risk among a certain population of gay male couples, specifically those who are HIV negative and here in the U.S., and then define certain components or rules that these couples, as well as practitioners who serve this population, may want to consider when establishing a sexual agreement. So a sexual agreement is this notion or term that many gay male couples have, and it's an explicit contract or understanding as to what sexual behaviors may occur within the relationship, so with the men together, as well as anything that may occur sexually outside the relationship, so with maybe a secondary sex partner. So as we know, MSM remain disproportionately affected by HIV/AIDS in the U.S., and certain groups of MSM are severely impacted, such as African-American, blacks, Hispanic, Latinos, and then also male couples. And currently, two-thirds of men who are partnered with another male acquire HIV in the context of their relationship. So a lot of the efforts of prevention and research really look at the individual level, and we're sort of discounting this notion of how much of an impact or influence our partners have on our sexual behaviors while in a relationship. Further, relationship research on sexual agreements have mostly occurred out in Australia and parts of Europe, and a little bit here in the U.S., mostly in San Francisco. And so there's this huge question as to whether adhering to an agreement or keeping it really reduces HIV risk among male couples who are HIV negative. So it's a big question mark, and it's been debated because of a number of reasons that I'll further go over. What we do know are reasons why gay men have unprotected anal intercourse with their main partners. And these reasons that are listed up here, especially for the 2 points, are no different than their heterosexual counterparts with female partners. I mean, love, intimacy, trust, commitment, satisfaction. These are all common reasons why people decide not to use condoms with their main partners. But where it begins to differ with male couples is relationship status or partner types, like the types of relationships that gay men have and other MSM have with their male partners really vary and differ compared to their heterosexual counterparts. And then not knowing one's HIV status or assuming it, and then this notion of sexual agreements that I further that I had explained earlier. So with prior research of sexual agreements, Colleen Hoff, myself, and a number of others have looked at various types, and I'll give you some examples. It's a huge continuum, but they typically range from one that is closed, which would mimic monogamy in the true sense, and then those that are open that would allow some sort of sex to happen outside the relationship. Reasons for establishing and breaking sexual agreements have been examined. Reasons for establishing are basically trust and honesty, regardless of the sexual status of the couple or the sexual agreement type. And then breaking these agreements are more contextual. For example, like the men felt desired or they're horny at that point in time. And then attitudes towards disclosing the breaks really. These men find it important to tell their partners that they broke their agreements, but what complicates the matter is their fear that the relationship will dissolve, and so therefore they're more reluctant to actually tell their partners. And then recently, I looked at factors associated with couples' concordance on aspects of their sexual agreement, meaning that men are both on the same page about having agreements, the same type of agreement, and then actually adhering to it. And those relationship factors are more common and reflect the reasons why they decide not to use condoms. So again, in my research question, and I wanted to really know like what factors are associated with one or both men in the couple adhering to their sexual agreement. So I used a cross-sectional study design, standard reciprocal DAG designed to collect the data. Simply means that I met with a male couple, and both men were paired with different laptops, and they completed the electronic anonymous questionnaire simultaneously yet independently. It contained about 100 questions. I targeted those who lived in Portland and Seattle in the Pacific Northwest and met those eligibility criteria, which, too, I'll point out, all the men lacked a known HIV infection or status, and they've had sex or anal intercourse in the previous 3 months. And multi-level modeling, as well as bivariate analyses, were used for this statistical analysis. So the questionnaire contained common demographics, sexual behavior. I normally just basically looked at UAI with a main partner, as well as any secondary partner in the previous 3 months, HIV SARA status, and last HIV test for self-reported and perceived partners, and then a number of relationship characteristics, including sexual agreements. The validated measures include the investment model for relationship commitment, trust scale, look at various entities regarding trust, and then the sexual agreement investment scale. Real quickly, the investment model, I think commitment level and satisfaction level with a relationship are pretty self-explanatory, but quality alternatives is this notion of comparing being with your current partner in the relationship to maybe being single is better than what I have currently, or maybe I perceive someone else out there to be a better partner for me. The investment size is how much investment you receive by being in that relationship, and that could be in two main forms, like a tangible good. So we pull our resources together to have a better apartment or in a better house, or it could be more of a social status that we pull our friends together or are more popular in the community. And predictability, dependability, and faith regarding trustworthiness and then valuing, committing, commitment and satisfaction toward one sexual agreement. And all these are related to the current partner. And so since I collected data from both men, I'm able to compare on the aspects of the sexual agreements. There was 142 couples. The analyses that I'm presenting today only look at data from the 58 couples. So I'll walk you through this diagram. So in the far right, you'll notice that there are 51 couples where one man said, yes, I have an agreement, yet his partner said, no, they did not. In the middle, so not a lot of agreement there. In the middle box, both men say that they didn't have an agreement. And then in the far left, 68 couples have both men concurring that they had an agreement. Of those 68, 58 agreed on their type of sexual agreements. And of those 58, 30 of the men, 30 couples have both men adhering to their sexual agreement. So my analysis is asking the question, what factors are associated with adherence to a sexual agreement is looking within those 58 couples. So, or 116 men, the average age was 35, not only for the individual, but also the couple. These men were mostly gay, white, urban, well-educated, employed men, so clearly not representative of all male couples in the U.S., but fairly so, at least in the Pacific Northwest. Most identified as gay. Within the previous 3 months, 92% stated that they had UAI with their main partner, and we expected that. And then 9% also had UAI with a secondary sex partner. Most reported HIV negative. The 4% to make up 100% stated that they weren't sure or chose I don't know. And then for HIV testing, less than a third stated they got tested in the previous 3 months. And out of those 58 couples, two men never tested for HIV. I can also state that out of the entire sample, 142 male couples, I think there was about 9 men who had never been tested for HIV. So for relationship characteristics, most of them lived with their main partner. Two-thirds have been with their partner more than 2 years, and a high percentage, 82%, discussed their sexual agreement in detail. The types of sexual agreements, 47% basically mimicked monogamy, 48% was open but had guidelines, and then 5% was open without guidelines. And there's lots of caveats to that, but I'll just quickly say that that 5% would probably be the most high-risk group because they don't have any sort of guidelines or boundaries as to what they could do sexually. So it was really open. They could do whatever they want. And that's how it was phrased in the questionnaire. For the relationship factors, regarding relationship commitment, trustworthiness, and then investment in one's sexual agreement, basically these men were committed to their partners, they trusted their partners on average, and were invested in their sexual agreements. So when I plugged everything into the multi-level model, I included those from the bivariate analyses that were statistically significant at 0.05 level, comparing adherence to non-adherence. And I controlled, in this multi-level model, I controlled for UA with the main partner since it's such a commonplace behavior, at least among this particular group of male couples. And so you'll see that being in a relationship less than 2 years, as well as viewing the partner trustworthiness, the men were significantly more likely to adhere to their sexual agreements. By no surprise, men who had engaged in UAI with a secondary sex partner were significantly less likely to adhere. Now this isn't like really, I guess, surprising, but I didn't ask about the components of sexual agreements within the questionnaire. So that was one big limitation. But it does sort of show the notion that these men are aware of HIV risk to some degree and have woven that into their agreements as a limitation or a boundary that they don't want their partners to engage in. And so we really need more research to better understand like what components these men would want in their sexual agreements, and more so, how can they increase the communication and comfort level of talking about these things. So if I quickly go back to this, you'll notice that a good proportion of this sample really aren't talking about their sexual agreements, or at least are on the same page, which is quite worrisome considering the vulnerability within this population. And then more so, since this research only conducted and it was conducted in the Pacific Northwest, and we know basically what's happening in San Francisco, the rest of the nation is a big question mark. And I think we really need to better understand like what motivates male couples to have these agreements more than just having more variety for like sex. And if it's fearful to disclose breaking an agreement, what can we do in order to help men seem protective of the relationship that it won't necessarily dissolve? And so I mentioned in the beginning that we were talking about components that not only researchers but male couples and practitioners would want to consider if we're going to promote or think about promoting sexual agreements as an HIV risk reduction strategy, at least among HIV negative male couples. So what are their knowledge about the transmission or risk, and do they perceive themselves at risk? What's the comfort level of sexual behavior in the activities? I can share that I collected data nationally from a large sample of male couples, and I asked about different activities that were mostly non-sex related, such as sharing different personal information, going on dates, things of that sort, because there was more of a reason why, just to sort of protect the core of that relationship. And then what would be an appropriate interval for testing within this population? And then similarly with frequency of communication and how to integrate biomedical techniques if they have trouble using condoms or slipped up, and making sure that PEP and PrEP were available to them. So all these things we need to sort of consider for like future research and the practicality of it. Thank you.